We have the highest level of chronic illness of any advanced democracy. Hillary, once she won the nomination, she did the same thing, unfortunately, that Biden is doing now. So the story is that in the former campaign, I used the F word too many times, and you know, it's like, damn it. Yeah. Gee, I can't even imagine, because they're owned, and we all know that they're owned.
Welcome to We The 66. This is the official podcast for the 66% of Americans who do not trust the news.
We're your hosts, Max.
And Max.
And we're also Roku News co-founders. So thank you for tuning in for a very special interview today.
When we travel the country, which we love to do, we love getting out of New York, we'd never do it enough. One of the most common things we hear from people is that they hate both parties.
Polling suggests these are not isolated cases. A large majority of Americans wish they had more political options. In 2004, 31% of Americans considered themselves politically independent. Now, a recent Gallup poll found that around 50% of Americans now do. So half the country is politically homeless, yet they still only have two houses to which they can belong.
So this reality prompted our investigation into the two-party system last week. We talked to political scientists and independent candidates on how the system operates and how difficult it's become for third-party candidates to get on ballots. If you missed it, email us at we the66rokenews.com and we will send it to you.
But it also got us thinking, what's it like for those people within their own parties who are trying to change things? One of these people is Marianne Williamson, potentially better known as Crazy Crystal Lady. And that is our guest on today's show.
So we found our conversation with Marianne to be, and yes, this may sound like a backhanded compliment, but she's also a politician. We found it way more interesting than we expected. She opened up about what it's like to be shunned by the Democratic Party, why it's done so, how her campaign has cost her friends, workplace abuse allegations in the media, and whether she is in fact Crazy Crystal Lady.
Now, this should go without saying, we do not endorse the politicians we have on here or anyone we have on here. We don't endorse their views. We want to give people a platform to talk, and we want to hear from different people that the media does not give much of a spotlight to.
So again, can't wait to dive into this. Also, make sure to subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. We appreciate it all. Thank you so much for the 5-star reviews already. Big news hates when you leave a 5-star review for We The 66.
And without further ado, we bring you Marianne Williamson.
Marianne, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
For those of our listeners who aren't too familiar with where your campaign is at, can you just give an overview of where the campaign is at right now?
Well, President Biden has already gotten the delegates. He will be the nominee for the Democratic Party. That's established now. But the primary states, some still haven't weighed in. And so I have continued so that I can hold the conversation that I feel matters most in those states where I am on the ballots. You know, a presidential campaign is an extraordinary platform for a deeper conversation. I agree with Martin Luther King, who said that your life begins to end on the day you stop talking about things that matter most. And I find it disgusting, to be honest, how little the establishment political system discusses the things that I believe matter most. And instead of being a conduit for the deeper analysis of where we are as a country and where we should be going, I find the political media industrial complex, as I call it, often that which obfuscates the deeper conversation and analysis. So I'm grateful to be out there continuing to have the dialogue with people that is obviously, you know, clearly appreciated, or there wouldn't be people at my talks.
So why do you think it is that some of the biggest news companies, biggest politicians in the world, the two parties, are neglecting issues that are so important to so many Americans?
Gee, I can't even imagine, because they're owned, and we all know that they're owned. We know, you know, ever since the Telecommunications Act in 1996, just a few conglomeratization, a few companies in this conglomeratization of media controls most of it. And unfortunately, the same corporate matrix, which includes all of them, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, big food, big agriculture, big chemical companies, gun manufacturers, big oil defense contractors, they own Washington. Washington itself has become a system of legalized bribery. And too often, the major political parties just enable those forces. It's not even just that they chop wood and carry water for that corporate matrix. They are a part of the corporate matrix. That's why. And I have something else to say about that. Most people know it now. You know, if you said this even 15 years ago, It's like, guys, wake up. People go, well, I don't know. That might be a little radical. Mm-hmm. Today, no, we're at a different point. And we need to realize this, I believe. This is not a time for more data analysis or data collection because people get it. Now we need the courage to harness the political power to actually turn this thing around.
What woke you up to these realities and made you care so much about not just politics, but, for example, the country's national health? When did this become your focus?
Oh, this is the house, the family I was born into. You know, my father took us to Vietnam to show us what war was when I was 12 years old. These were the conversations at dinner. You know, my father was saying the CIA killed Kennedy on the night he died. So, you know, this is, my father died in 1994. I think I'm still trying to get his approval.
He took you to Vietnam to see war?
1965.
What was that like?
Well, the actual battle, it was about 5 miles outside Saigon. So if you were in Saigon, I mean, 5 miles is pretty close. You could still land there. I remember it was the steepest landing of an airplane I've ever been in. It was, you know, people used to say to my father, because we traveled a lot, I mean, all over the world, and I was in countries like within the Soviet Union, et cetera, when I was younger. So my father, people used to say to my father, why are you taking your kids traveling at this age? They'll never remember everything. And my father used to say it will get under their skin. Hmm. And he's right. It did. There's a lot of American propaganda I've simply not been vulnerable to, not only because of what my father taught me, but because of what my parents showed me, namely that people are the same everywhere.
Well, it's interesting. I just saw yesterday a meme that showed the first McDonald's opened in Vietnam. And it says, you know, Victory America, essentially, was the subject. And now I do think a lot of people would say that, you know, the resilience of America's capitalist system, so on, is what enables American companies to go around the world. And it's this positive thing. Vietnam now is a much more prosperous, wealthy country than it used to be because of adopting free market policies, whatever people may say. How do you view it differently?
They won, we lost. And we should never have been there. And it was an imperialistic criminal enterprise that we ever were. I mean, you know, that's the era I grew up in. Anti-war protests, Daniel Ellsberg, the Pentagon Papers. It was horrifying. And it was unfortunately a mistake that we repeated. You know, I remember the beginning of the Iraq War and the run-up to the Iraq War. I remember I was one of those people saying, this is Vietnam all over again. People saying, oh, that's such a facile analysis. No, it wasn't. It was the continuation of the same imperialistic military-industrial complex forever war machine. McDonald's opening in Vietnam does not mean victory for American capitalism, but I'm happy for the Vietnamese people that they are the thriving nation that they are.
Marianne, it's a very unique childhood you had to just get up at 12 years old, head to Vietnam. I'm curious to hear more about that upbringing because a lot of people would hear what you said your father believed about Kennedy's death and would call him a conspiracy theorist. Did you grow up in a conspiracy theorist household or?
No, and by the way, that's not a conspiracy theory. There was clearly a conspiracy that killed Kennedy. I mean, it's almost like it's, you know, that's, I think most Americans know that something went down there. Mm-hmm. Most Americans believe that something went down there more than just the single bullet theory, Lee Harvey Oswald and so forth. My father, let's be very clear. My father fought in World War II. My father was certainly a left wing, immigration lawyer in the United States. But this was a different, we had an American flagpole on our front yard. So my father criticized American policy the same way I do. He loved this country. I love this country. But he used to walk around the house saying, beat the system, kids, beat the system, kids. And he was right. No, my father was a very, you know, very successful immigration lawyer. I certainly grew up with a lot of passion on that topic. And but my father was a great lover of what this country should be and is at its best. You know, till the day he died in 1994, anytime there was a presidential election, if you said, Daddy, who'd you vote for? He would say, Roosevelt.
So for you, you're extremely critical of the two parties and the system that they have created. Yet you're also running within one of the parties. You're not an independent. Why are you a Democrat, given that? And what does it feel like to be blocked out of the party you claim to be a part of?
Sad. I think of myself as a Roosevelt Democrat. Like I said, I grew up in a house where, you know, huzzah, huzzah, Roosevelt. I believe that my policies reflect a Rooseveltian, traditional perspective on the Democratic Party, that government policy should help people thrive, and that the perspective of the party should always be unequivocal, unabashed advocacy for the working people of the United States. And so I have a kind of nostalgia for that, but I'm beginning to more and more feel, much like many Republicans do, they didn't leave their party, the party left them. I feel, you know, a lot of the people who would look at someone like myself and say, you're trying to hijack the party. No, they hijacked the party. People like myself are Eleanor and Franklin. They're the DuPonts and the Whitneys and the Morgans. They represent the interests of the economic royalists that Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal repudiated. So I suppose on a certain level it was naive. Now remember, I ran in 2020 also. They were not as vicious. They were satisfied to just make fun of me, paint me as silly crystal kooky lady. This time I saw how things really work at a deeper level if they consider you any level of a threat.
You bring up the media industrial complex, which, by the way, is an amazing term. We're going to steal that. And it's relevant to Rocha. We started because we feel that the, as you point out, a conglomeratized industry holds narrative monopolies. It blacklists people. It labels people as loons that aren't loons.
Absolutely.
It has shrunk the Overton window of what's acceptable conversation. And you've been, of course, a victim of this. You've been called a crazy person, specifically on your science and spirituality views. What about your characterization in the media do you feel is most inaccurate?
Well, first of all, that there's nothing science about me, nothing anti-science that I've ever said. I don't think anyone who knows my work, you know, people opine about my books who've never read them. This year, I notice I'm a quote-unquote self-help author. Any way that they can diminish your work. Harvey Kay, the historian Harvey Kay, you might have had on your program, said that my book, A Politics of Love, was the best campaign book he had ever read. There's a term, contempt prior to investigation. So there was the decision to paint me a certain way that had nothing to do with who I actually am. It's the politics of personal destruction. Even my spiritual beliefs, I write books and have for years and given talks, done counseling, based on universal spiritual themes that are at the heart of all the great religious and spiritual teachings. I write about Buddha, I write about Jesus, I write about Moses. I mean, you know, it's actually pretty traditional, non-denominational stuff. So, and even The Course in Miracles, which I've written books about, it's not a religion, there's no dogma, there's no doctrine. It's a psychological self-study program, the psychology of faith, the psychology of forgiveness. The psychology of being able to let go of the past and living in the present, opening to a future, living with compassion, giving up grievances. What's insane, you know, Krishnamurti said, there's nothing, his comment, something about, there's nothing so wonderful about being mentally well adjusted to a sick society. I believe, I agree with Gandhi, who said that the problem with the world is that humanity is not in its right mind. To me, the idea that we should try to love one another is not only common sense, but the opposite of woo-woo. The idea that we should be spending the majority of our resources at this point on ways to harm rather than ways to help each other That's what's insane.
One thing that's interesting about the media's coverage of you is in the same article, they'll write you off as crazy. And then later on, that what you're saying is dangerous, which is kind of a funny combination. There is an article that we read in preparation for this where Rolling Stone talked about something you had said about antidepressants, which is interesting for a few reasons. But one thing that we talk about a lot is there are conversations that people have in the privacy of their homes that the media refuses to reflect. One of those conversations, you touch on many of these conversations about spirituality, where it's kind of written off by the media, about the efficacy, the safety of antidepressants and other psychiatric drugs. But it's just interesting that at the same time, they can say, oh yeah, she's a self-help author, write her off. Then turn and say, but what she's saying is dangerous. And that's a very strange dynamic. That it's applied to you. I think it's applied to RFK. It's applied to a lot of people who challenge the mainstream narrative on things.
You know, it's interesting because the things I said about antidepressants, they're not talking about that this time. Why? Because everything I said has been proven to be true. And the things that their stuff has been debunked. That's why they don't bring that up this time, because they know that I was right. That I talked about the overprescription of all, of a lot of medical, pharmaceutical remedies in this country. And I talked about the situational aspects of so much of depression in the United States. When you have 70% of Americans who say that they live with constant economic stress, when you have people in their 20s, the 20s are hard, but it's not a mental illness. But when you carry tens of thousands of dollars of college loan debt, and the only reason you were even getting those loans was because you want to better your life, and we think it's surprising that someone's depressed, surprising that someone's anxious when you have one in four Americans living with medical debt. So the system that wanted to take me on with this, it's a constant displacement technique. They never want to talk about what's true. So when somebody brings up that, wait a minute, there's a different conversation we should be having here, of course they see that person as dangerous, because that person is dangerous to their reign of illusion. Listen, when they have said that their big thing is that I'm not serious, they say that because they know how serious I am. They call me unserious. I would say to you, I'm the only candidate who's been having this most serious conversations about what's really going on in this country, about the fact that 80% of Americans are basically struggling to survive, what we're really doing to this planet, what we're doing around the world. Mine has been the most serious candidacy. So of course they've called it unserious.
It's interesting to hear you talk about antidepressants, because in your own story, you describe your 20s as a very, very dark time in your life due to, I think, your famous line of bad drugs and bad boyfriends. Looking back on that time, if it was today, how do you think the medical establishment would have handled your case, and how should a tough, tumultuous 20s like yours be dealt with by medicine?
I'm not a doctor, so I'm not claiming to play that role, nor am I saying that there's never a role for psychotherapeutic drugs. I don't go there. I never have gone there. I'm very careful, and I don't do that. But I will say this, as I said before, the 20s are hard. For every generation, they're hard. They're not, however, a mental illness. They're a period of individuation. It's hard. Plus, I think today it's even harder. You know, I don't agree with President Biden when he says about young people today, it's no different than when I was growing up. Yes, it is.
Why do you think, so to go back, I think it was in Rolling Stone, the article that mentioned the antidepressant stuff, it called you dangerous.
You really read this article, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, it gets to something that we discuss. I mean, it's the underlying reason that we started ROCA, is a lot of media outlets and the journalists within them they're pursuing an agenda over the truth. And this happens on both sides. This happens all over the place. With that, the one thing we discuss is why people do it, why a journalist wants to come after somebody, and why there's so many instances of this, whether with you or others, where you can see they have an axe to grind. And the question is why some 28-year-old sitting in an office in New York feels the need to do this. And it's a question of, is this how you get promoted? Is this just what they're kind of indoctrinated with through education? Why do you think it is?
We have a terrible ethical breakdown in the United States today. As far as those young journalists are concerned, did they never take ethics classes? the ease with which people smear people today, the ease with which people lie, even and misinform, disinform, even within traditional news platforms that people should be able to trust. It's turning us into, first of all, there's a mean-spiritedness. You know, it's a level of abuse. You know, when you do online bullying of a child, we call it online bullying. When you do online, it's abusive. I mean, it's abusive. And I will say, there are things that have been said about me, stories that have been told about me, narratives that have been spun about me, that I absolutely do not believe would have been done had I been a man. And I've never felt that way in my career. I've had an over 40-year career. I never felt that my sex in any way limited my opportunities or obstructed people's perception of me. But in politics, it is outrageous. Something that happened in my campaign described one way if it was a man's campaign, another way if it's mine. And I'll tell you something else that I find just fascinating from a psychological perspective. It's psychological witch burning. You'd think it was the 16th century. She's crazy, she's crazy, she's crazy. She's mean, she's like Hansel and Gretel's wicked witch. It's kind of fascinating, but horrifying.
All right, so on that note, I got to ask about the Politico article that depicted you as a outraged boss, throwing phones, foaming at the mouth, all of that.
Foaming at the mouth? Was there one that said I was foaming at the mouth?
I think there was a description that you were foaming at the mouth.
Yeah. Well, look at, and I could show you an article about Joe Biden and any man in the office. So the story is that in the former campaign, I used the F word too many times. And, you know, it's like, damn it.
Yeah.
This is yes. Yeah. You know, that happened. It absolutely right. happened. In this particular campaign, though, there were a couple of people with whom I never even had a crossword, who spread lies and said things that were very deleterious to the campaign and that were just outright lies.
What's your reaction when an article like that is published, when you first read it?
Well, I had a different reaction when I first read it to what I had later. When I first read it, I thought it was so outrageous. Show me any man who's ever not said the F word in the office. And I couldn't even believe the lies that have been told by the people. There are political hitmen. People have no idea how this thing really runs. At first, I think I wasn't as worried as I should have been because I thought, who's going to buy this? Later, I realized what a deep damage it did to my campaign. I realized who had done it, and I realized that, wow, this is how the system works. The system is so much more corrupt than I even knew.
So back to the, you know, you and the Democratic Party and this image. What is it? Do you ever find yourself at events with the Democratic establishment? Where do you fit in the party, and how on a day-to-day are you treated?
Well, we've already talked about how I've been treated in the press.
Yeah.
There were times when I would be going to a Democratic, like Young Democrats event, the ones that I hadn't been blocked at. I would walk in the room. You'd think I was a criminal. I'm an FEC registered qualified candidate primarying an incumbent, just like people primary incumbent senators, people primary incumbent congresspeople. There is no special assignation in the U.S. Constitution for incumbency. And yet there was this DNC narrative, like talking points. We're going with Biden. There will be no primary. And people, I would walk in, and just the looks I would get from people, the energy, like, and sometimes people would say outright, well, congratulations for electing Trump. You know, a lot of people treated me that way. How could you do this, Marianne? Don't you understand there's a fascist at the door? I've done it because there's a fascist at the door. This is not fun, what I have been through for the last year. This is not fun. You don't do, people say she's on an ego trip. It is the most ego-destroying thing you can possibly imagine.
Have you lost friends during your campaign?
Not real friends, but I've learned that some friends were not friends. I've learned Listen, a fair weather friend was never a friend. Yeah, have I been abandoned by people that I certainly tried to be there for them? Yeah, absolutely. I think I was deemed radioactive, so they thought, well, if she's radioactive and I support her, I'll be deemed radioactive. And a lot of contempt prior to investigation. But I'd like to, if I might, go back to that business about the fascists at the door. I agree with Franklin Roosevelt that we would not have to worry about a fascist takeover in the United States if democracy delivers on its promises. And I have felt strongly that a fascist should never have gotten so close to the door. Something was wrong that he even got so close. And then obviously got through the door in 2016. So I believe that things like universal health care and improved Medicare for all, subsidized child care, tuition-free college and tech school, complete eradication of the college loan debt, using the Higher Education Act, guaranteed sick pay, guaranteed living wage, a jobs guarantee. These, to me, are the ways to defeat the fascists by presenting to the American people a genuine alternative. We will not win in 2024 just by telling people, be scared, be very scared. This is going to be much more like 2016 than 2020. And I don't think the real electoral risk to the Democrats is people voting for Trump. It's people staying home and people taking third party options. And once again, even there, the Democratic Party should not be spending all its time and money seeking to suppress the candidacies of its opponents, which they're trying to do now with Bobby the way they did with me during the primary. Why don't you spend that same money and focus and resources in developing policies that will make people want to vote for you? Tell us what you're going to do for the next 4 years.
I think some people will point to places in Europe in particular. I think Sweden and other countries where they have very comprehensive welfare nets. They have everything that you're talking about from a policy perspective. Yet you still have this rising tide of pretty far-right politicians sweeping to power. I think it's Sweden where, I don't know, one of those countries has in particular, Nordic countries, has a very far-right government.
Wait. No, sorry, go on.
So assuming you address all these social issues, you still have this stuff coming, or maybe they're not addressing it, but what do you think when you look at that? Countries that have the policies you want and still have this rising tide of far-right nationalistic politics, whatever it may be.
But the far-right nationalistic policies that are politics that's rising up in many of those countries is not in rejection of their healthcare system. That's not what it's coming from. It's coming from this clash of civilizations that's occurring all over the world, and the sort of rise of the bad guys. But the bad guys aren't saying, let's tear down our medical system. I mean, you know, and that's not what it's coming from.
What I'm wondering is, the policies even sufficient, or is it other stuff? You know, a lot of people would say it's this political correctness. Obviously, when Trump won in 2016, a lot of people attributed it to political correctness, now wokeness, now all this kind of stuff that people talk about, where a lot of people say policies don't even matter for getting elected, right? And politics is more about Trump has a sway over a large group of the people, and he can communicate with them, and policies, whatever. What do you think about that?
I think policies very much matter. If you look at 2016, there were two people who said to the American people, your rage is legitimate. Your pain is valid. The system is rigged against you, and you deserve much better. Those two people were Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. The difference is that Bernie meant it, and Bernie had policies that would have actually ameliorated a lot of the suffering that people were going through. We know that the Democratic Party put their hands on the scale in favor of Hillary. I personally think if they had not done that, I don't know if it would have been Hillary or Bernie who would have won the primary. None of us can know. But I think Democrats would have felt good about the race, and I don't think Trump would have ever been president. Hillary, once she won the nomination, she did the same thing, unfortunately, that Biden is doing now. She said, let's continue with the success of the last 8 years. And millions of Americans said, what success, lady? I'm drowning here. Mm. So I think policies very much matter. The problem is that people were not given the opportunity to vote for Bernie's policies that I think absolutely would have won the day.
Marianne, I'm so glad you brought that up. That's actually one issue we wanted to talk about on the subject of how the inner workings of the Democratic Party. So 2020, obviously 2016, you said they placed their hand on the scale. But also in 2020, on the eve of Super Tuesday, when it was a dead heat, and all of a sudden, at once, you have, I think, Klobuchar, Mayor Pete, both endorsed Biden. Elizabeth Warren refused to endorse Biden. Beto campaigned in Texas for Biden. Elizabeth Warren refused to endorse Bernie, with whom she was more politically similar. What do you think happened behind the scenes? Do you have any insight there?
Of course, we all know what happened. A phone call was made. And we all pretty much know the only person in America who would have been powerful enough to make that phone call.
Who is that?
A former president, and we all know that.
Mm.
I mean, we all have to stop pretending now.
Yeah. So you think that...
Because it was Biden himself putting the call. Amy had said, would you leave now?
And that certain former president, I think we know who we're talking about, has that much sway to still.
Well, somebody made that phone call, and I don't have any inside information. I can't imagine anyone else who would have had the power to do that.
What about, you talk about, I mean, the how DC's bought and paid for. Do you feel the media's bought and paid for as well? I mean, to what extent do you think Big Pharma and, say, Big Defense have a grip on the media? And also, I'd love to hear how, you know, if you have any thoughts on how exactly it plays out, their influence with the parties.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely it does. So that's why I call it a political media industrial complex. You know, in 2020, I was on CNN fairly often. I had a CNN town hall. I was on MSNBC fairly often, I think for a minor, obviously minor candidate at that time. I think I had no complaints. This time I was blacklisted. I was blacklisted on CNN, nothing. No Sunday shows, not one Sunday morning show. I saw George Stephanopoulos mention me one day, oh, but she's just a message candidate. So they say that, right, as though they get to declare it a completely blacklisted on MSNBC. So when my numbers in the polls were the same as Nikki Haley's, hers was called a surge. Mine was ignored, completely invisibilized. Even mainstream media sources saying the president has no opponent. Excuse me, that is an outright lie. So they were taking direction. The idea that Fox serves GOP, but CNN and MSNBC don't serve the DNC is ridiculous. Clearly, someone saw my... I had one interview with Jonathan Carl on ABC the day I announced. I think I announced on a Saturday. It was shown on Sunday. And somebody said, don't let that woman have a viral moment no matter what you do. And it was just... Joe Rogan wouldn't have me, Lex Fridman wouldn't have me, Amy Goodman wouldn't have me until the morning of the New Hampshire primary. She had Cornel West the day after. Elon Musk had DeSantis for Twitter Spaces, had Dean Phillips for Twitter Spaces, had Bobby Kennedy for Twitter Spaces. He said, I will have a Twitter Space with any presidential candidate. I said publicly several times, I'd love to do that. No, there was an invisibilization and an erasure that I think is very scary. Candidate suppression is a form of voter suppression. And I think that the media, as well as the party, have a responsibility. You know, the traditional role of a political party is to stay in the background, and the people, the voters, are supposed to decide who gets to be the nominee, and then the party comes forward. This is why George Washington, in his farewell address, said that he feared political parties would form factions of men more loyal to their party than to their country. And John Adams also said he saw them as the greatest risk. But as I'm sure you realize, after the 2016 election, some ex-Bernie supporters took the DNC to court and said you weren't fair. And the DNC defense was, hey, we're not a government institution. We're not a government agency. We don't owe it to people to be fair, to the point where now they're unabashed about it. They don't even pretend. Then that's why they said at the beginning, I remember watching Simone Sanders and others, we will not have a primary. Our job is to support the president's renomination. But I'll tell you something else. I'm out on the road still. And when I've spoken in Chicago, Arizona, New York, Connecticut, California, you know, even places since, the spell has broken. And now that, you know, people were so like, it has to be Biden, it has to be Biden. DNC says it has to be Biden, it has to be Biden. now people have moved into a new phase because that particular energetic curtain has been raised, and people are like, oh, it's Biden.
One of the, I mean, when our audience sees this, I'm sure many of them are going to agree, given that almost all young people are not excited at the minimum about him. But, you know, one thing that's interesting, I think, with our generation, when RFK went on Joe Rogan, overnight, it transformed millions of people's perceptions of him. And the power that shattering an otherwise media blackout on him. It seems like you haven't had that same moment, though, or at least not on that scale. I'm wondering, the Rogan example is really interesting because I would assume that he would have you on. I mean, you seem to fit his, simply just for the conversation. I mean, that's what he does. And it's interesting that you haven't been on the show. That surprises me.
Even Jon Stewart wouldn't have me on. And I don't know, but I assume it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, that they think I'm my doppelganger. You know, some of these people who have not been willing to have me, I kind of think they would like me.
You know,
there are people who I agree with on a lot of things. But, you know, you pitch a show and you don't even get a response. And you're right. I do believe that. I think that if I had been on Joe Rogan, if I had been given the exposure, when I see my audiences today, the enthusiasm, the standing ovations, I think if I'd had a chance for exposure that to me simply would have been journalistic integrity to allow, who are these people? We're carrying that kind of power to say we have the right to curate who the candidates will be. I think it's terrible. You know, I did an IG Live with Gabor Mate. He said that he had been raised in Hungary, and speaking himself, he said, I was raised in a controlled society. He said, I know what it is. This is even more controlled because it's so much more sophisticated.
So we're running, I know we don't have too much more time, but we'd love to do sort of some quick hitters on policy issues or various other questions we have because there's so much ground we wanted to cover. Number one, you know Hollywood well. You've had high profile endorsements in the past from Kim Kardashian, well-documented friendship with Oprah Winfrey. With all the accusations about Diddy and the new Nickelodeon documentary and Cat Williams allegations, all these allegations stirring about a Hollywood and entertainment culture that's creepy and corrupt, what's your take on all these allegations?
Well, in terms of specific allegations, I mean, everyone is innocent until proven guilty. I respect our judicial system, and people who are tried, you know, should be tried in a court of law. I don't believe in trying people in the media. Where I thought you were going with that was the silence of so many particularly progressive people in Hollywood. I was not only saddened to see how many progressives in Washington just folded with the Biden administration, and supposedly progressive nonprofits just folded, not only endorsing the president, but not with any leverage or getting anything for it. What I sense is happening in Hollywood today, and what I know is happening in many cases, people are terrified. They're terrified of getting canceled on social media and it affecting their movie, it affecting their television show, their Netflix deal, et cetera. People are scared in America today. And then they would look at me and say, well, look what happened to her, and they'd be right. So we've gotta stand up to all this bullying. People have gotta purify their own hearts. I see the smug, self-righteous, angry, I see it on the left as well as on the right. It's truly tearing down the fabric of our society.
One more policy question quickly, as Teresa, we're running out of time. Wars in the Middle East and Ukraine, you want to create a Department of Peace, and you speak about this often. What do you think of the solutions specifically, not, you know, philosophically, but specifically to the war in Ukraine and Gaza?
I don't think a Department of Peace would have had much to say about what's happening now, but they would have, a Department of Peace would have had a lot to say in terms of preventing them both. A Department of Peace, for instance, when you look at the United States does not have clean hands with NATO, with the Aegis missiles in Poland, etc. None of that, I don't believe, justifies the behavior of Vladimir Putin, but a Department of Peace, which would answer to the president, would have been a voice pointing out that we were poking the bear. You know, Roosevelt said we need to do more than end wars, we need to end the beginnings of all wars. A Department of Peace weighing in on the Middle East would have been a voice saying to an American president much, much earlier, as in years earlier, we must be vocal about this, that the occupation is illegal, that the settlements are illegal, that the siege is so wrong. We were, if you took any kind of preventative approach, either to Ukraine or to what has happened in the Middle East, you would have recognized long before hostilities began that the brew was there, the elements were there, and something was bound to blow. In terms of what is happening now, I do believe in Ukraine, and I have wavered at one point, but I think I'm back to, I basically agree with the president on Ukraine. I don't, you know, if you talk to left-wingers in Europe, they don't have this view that many have here. This is just anecdotal, but it was an example of much of what I've encountered. I was on a train in England, and I was with a young couple from the Czech Republic. And the war had not been going on that long. And I asked them their view on it. You know, when you have Sweden wanting to be in NATO and Finland wanting to be in NATO, and you look at the views of the Baltic states and the Europeans. So I've taken I haven't looked at what's happening in Ukraine only from an American perspective. Or even a Ukrainian perspective. I look at it from a Western perspective, right? And also with, you know, a fair amount of knowledge of World War II and what this, the larger view of protection of Western values. So I was talking to this young couple, and I said to them, well, you know, a lot of people in the United States are very concerned because, you know, Putin has nuclear weapons. And this young man leaned into me and he said, if Putin uses a nuclear weapon, it will be on us. It won't be on you. Please hear me. We are more afraid of his invading us that we are afraid of his nuclear weapons. And the intensity with which he said that has stayed with me. In terms of the Middle East, what is happening even as you and I are speaking in Rafah, for instance, is absolutely catastrophic, obviously, and it is unacceptable. We need a ceasefire, we need a release of the hostages, and we need architecture for a two-state solution. Bill Clinton tried. The one who had it right was Jimmy Carter. And if I had been president 30 years ago, he would have been my Middle East liaison. And I would have been, as a president before October 7th, far more vocal. I would not have been just talking to Netanyahu in private. I would have been saying the things that needed to be said and that need to be said now. I agree with Senator Schumer's speech the other day about Netanyahu. I don't understand why Biden doesn't just say no. We should not be giving one more dollar to this policy. We should not be giving one more weapon. We need to get on to a new era and a two-state solution.
And then one more policy issue before we close with rapid fire, a little more upbeat and just asking about some of your favorite things. But the last issue is so funny comparing your website, your campaign website with others where every other economy, immigration, border, and then yours begins with health, which is fascinating. What are the biggest health problems facing America today?
Thank you for asking, because to me, this is a really big deal. I had actually talked about it on the debate stage last year. First of all, I am for an improved Medicare for all. Improved meaning that we would have eyeglasses and hearing aids and dental and mental health. However, we can't just treat the symptoms of disease. We have to talk about root causes. A lot of my policy decisions have to do with addressing root causes rather than just symptoms. We have the highest level of chronic illness of any advanced democracy. We have carcinogens allowed in our food that are not allowed in other advanced democracies, GMOs and so forth. We have chemicals in our pesticides. We have toxins in our air that so contribute to people's sickness, not even to mention the fact that we have, you know, we have 18 million Americans who cannot afford the prescriptions that their doctors give them. We have 1.3 million Americans who are rationing their insulin and so forth. So we have a system completely held hostage by the institutionalized greed of the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies. But once again, food, big ag, all those things have to do with the quality of our food, the quality of things that we are ingesting. 46% of the urban water wells in the United States are filled with PFAS, these chemicals. But there's one, so if somebody looks at my whole health plan on 2024.com, this is to me my favorite part of it. Most doctors in the United States were trained in a pharmaceutical model of Western medicine. Okay. Therefore, it is only reasonable to assume that after their diagnosis, their prescription will be along the line of pharmaceutical remedy, which in many cases is obviously appropriate. However, in my whole health plan, you go to the doctor gives you a diagnosis, the doctor gives you a prescription. It is mandated by law in my plan that there is now a database. Whatever sickness or condition the doctor is speaking to, there will now be the data that that reflects any non-allopathic, non-pharmaceutical-based remedy that is proven statistically to have anywhere near as efficacious a result. You are told about that. You are, it is mandated by law. You will be told about that, and your insurance will cover that as well.
I think there are forces that restrict the what's acceptable to discuss on health. And I mean, you even look at what we learned in school, the food pyramid. You learn just basic history about things that we sort of it's not based on science.
And one thing that's funny is, you know,
when you even talk about mental health, when the last time when it was talking about how I was, quote unquote, irresponsible on
right.
mental health. That was Big Pharma coming right at me.
Well, it's funny how, you know, you always hear people, they go on vacation to Europe and they come back and they say, oh, I felt better. Like it's just like it's a cute little thing. When in reality, it's because they're not absorbing toxins and all this kind of stuff that here we know we're consuming constantly and it's terrible.
All right.
Anyways.
Marianne, we covered a lot of ground today. So let's end on a bright note. We're going to ask you some rapid fire questions. Okay. And all right, here we go. Question number one, what is your favorite movie?
The Mission.
The Mission.
Yeah, The Mission and a movie that Henry Jaglom made called Deja Vu.
The Mission is a great one. A Ennio Morricone soundtrack. Robert De Niro, Jeremy Irons.
I know that soundtrack.
Liam, oh, the best.
Okay, you have to move off the grid to get away from all of the pitfalls of modern society. Where are you moving to?
I don't know. Because I think of the land, I would say Montana, but then I think of the people and some of the political forces in Montana.
You need to buy a gun, Marianne. You need a couple guns up there.
I know.
Highest gun ownership rate any state.
I don't know.
Okay, all right. Next question. You're on a road trip and you stop at the gas station. What snack are you getting?
This is going to sound really bougie, but I doubt that I would get a snack.
There you. I mean, listen, you're the health candidate, the nutty health candidate, of course.
I mean, I would be tempted by corn nuts.
Okay. Wow.
I would tell myself that.
All right. That is out of left field.
If it's any conciliation, he bought a banana at Dunkin' Donuts last week.
Yeah.
If you can buy a banana.
And who is your favorite comedian?
My favorite comedian, George Carlin.
And if we could
and also there was he was a black comedian who died.
Richard Pryor.
Yes.
Richard Pryor, the goats. I actually have one last one, which is you traveled a lot around the country. What would the last state standing be in a zombie apocalypse?
I guess Hawaii or Alaska.
You're thinking geographically. I like that. You're not thinking about like the craziest people.
Listen, there are wonderful people all over this country. That is one of the most beautiful aspects of running for office. The people of the United States are not the problem. That's what I've learned, and I've learned it twice. The people of the United States are not the problem. The problem is this sclerotic political system that acts like a lid, suppressing the will of the American people. The American people are decent, intelligent, and noble when called to be.
I'm so glad to end on that note because we feel that every time we get out of New York and hit the road. And it's just stunning the hostility and condescension a lot of media companies feel toward everyday people.
People need to get out more. And people
they need to get out more.
They're in LA, they're in Washington, New York,
right?
Sun Valley. They really need to get out more.
And it's not even a partisan thing. It's just a, yeah.
And we paid a terrible price for that in 2016. Hope it's not repeated in 24.
Well, Marianne, thank you so much for coming on. We would hopefully love to talk to you again sometime in this election cycle. But
yeah, good luck to you guys.
Thank you so much, Marianne. This was terrific.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day. All right. So that was Marianne Williamson. Very interesting conversation. She is great on TV.
She's a fascinating person to speak to, and she's such an interesting case study because she's someone that you hear so much more about than you see.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it also the media industrial complex, as she says, gaslights you, to use a Gen Z term, into having to apologize for conversations with people like her where you're like, I know she's like crazy, but... And in reality, that's just a ridiculous... I mean, you could argue that it's crazy to be sort of an in-the-system politician today.
You know, I was talking to someone about her the other day, and they said, oh, isn't she the crazy lady, something. But then what I said, I was like, a lot of her views definitely are like what views that a lot of friends of mine, a lot of people I know, certainly in a place like New York, a lot of people hold those same exact views. It's just that when you're a public figure running for president and you subject those views to scrutiny, but a lot of people behind closed doors talk about the same stuff she's saying and have no problem saying it. It looks different when you're a presidential candidate than someone at a dinner table saying this stuff.
Well, absolutely. Now we're going to pivot here and do a little bit of trivia, okay? So we're going to give a couple prompts. We'll see how this goes. And also send in segment recommendations. You guys have sent in some great ones so far. So I'm going to start off with a couple trivia questions for Max Frost. Ready?
Mm.
Can you name the top five homicide capitals in the U.S.?
As in murder rates?
City by murder rate in 2023.
Okay. St. Louis.
That is number one.
Baltimore.
That is number two.
Detroit.
Number four. Damn, this guy looks at homicide rankings all day.
One Max does that. It's not me.
You're missing three and five.
Yeah. Oakland?
Great guess. Actually, mid guess. It's 18.
I get two more guesses.
Okay, two more guesses.
Okay, so far we've got... Detroit, Baltimore, and St. Louis.
So three and five. You definitely know three.
It's not Chicago.
Nope, that's 10.
Chicago gets the worst rep.
Right, it's always. I'm sure Southside were its own city would be different, but...
Chirac,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm stumped.
New Orleans is number three.
Oh, I knew
and
that.
And number five is Cleveland.
Cleveland,
Ohio. That surprised me, too.
Wow. Okay.
Another one. Can you name the three words in English language that start with DW? DW. There are only three. And it doesn't count dweeb.
Why not?
I don't know, because I think that's like slang. When you hear them, you'll be like, oh, maybe that's why they don't count dweeb. They're pretty common.
Dwarf.
Correct.
Dwarfed.
No. They have to be like... Yeah. Dwarfing.
Okay. Dwarf. Dwell.
Perfect. This is pretty good. I've asked this to people before. My dates are going poorly. I ask them, name the three words.
Anyone ever get
can
it?
Do it? Yeah. They're like, check, please.
Dwarf. Dwell. Dwindle.
That's not bad.
Wow.
There you go. That's pretty good.
I'm feeling good.
All right. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We really, really appreciate it. And make sure to, again, subscribe. And thank you for all the love. We cannot wait for the next couple episodes.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to We the 66. We will be back soon.
We will be back soon.